63 degrees and rainy. In New York City, 59 degrees and overcast. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Africa Now! Today's show features Jacob H. Carruthers and the Restoration of an African Worldview with Kamal Rashid. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Mwiza Muntali. The music in the background is Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley and the Wailers, commemorating Human Rights Day, which was yesterday, December 10. Today we're going to feature a conversation with Dr. Kamal Rashid, in which he explores Jacob H. Carruthers and the restoration of an African worldview. Here is Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope with the conversation.
In the introduction of his recently published Jacob H. Carruthers and the Restoration of an African Worldview, Finding Our Way Through the Desert, Kamal Rashid posits that one of the central concerns evident in the scholarship of Jacob H. Carruthers was the intellectual foundations of the modern world. Although he acknowledged the importance of studying systems of oppression, he argued that such structures rested upon the foundation of Western thought, forms of knowledge that facilitated the formation of our most current systems of domination. In addition, these forms of knowledge also serve the primary function to maintain a particular worldview, as their application is constantly being refined and reinforced through false ideas about reality. Carruthers' work is occupied by a fundamental question that asks, how can African people who hope to free themselves from these structural and reinforcing mechanisms of domination do so when their conceptions of reality are constantly measured and derived from these very same ways of knowing that support these mechanisms of domination? El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz highlights this very point when, in his April 3rd, 1964, The Ballot of the Bullet speech in Cleveland, Ohio, argued that we need new friends, we need new allies, we need to expand the civil rights struggle to a higher level, to the level of human rights. Whenever you are in a civil rights struggle, whether you know it or not, you are confining yourself to the jurisdiction of Uncle Sam. No one from the outside world can speak out on your behalf as long as your struggle is a civil rights struggle. Civil rights come within the domestic affairs of this country. When you take your case to Washington, D.C., you are taking it to the criminal who's responsible. It's like running from the wolf to the fox. In simplest terms, Brother Malcolm asked, how can the Black Freedom Movement seek redress in a narrow conceptualization of civil rights when the very conceptualization of what is civil and what are the rights that are encapsulated in this, quote, civil, are adjudicated from the very system and institutions that define them? From the position of Carruthers, Malcolm, and others before him, this way of seeking to address the problems of the Africana world could only reproduce the conditions ultimately responsible for its subjugation. And therefore, it can only be concluded that any process of social transformation must be predicated upon an Africanization, or a re-Africanization to be exact. Kamal Rashid, thinking of Carruthers, writes further that knowledge, its production, legitimization, and transmission are shaped by the power relations of a society and through this, society's institutions. Therefore, the elite members of the politically dominant culture strategically impose their knowledge and worldview priorities in a way that legitimizes their authority through these institutions. Accordingly, there is little room for debate when it is argued that schooling in the United States is a principal instrument of this hegemony. It is a process that does not typically privilege critical thought and action, but instead encourages conformity to hegemony, rewards apathy to the status quo, and punish agency with regard to ideation or advocacy for revolutionary social change. From this perspective, it is no surprise then that the operationalization of schooling is little more than a means for sustaining the legitimacy for a specific form of social, political, and economic order. Examining the work of Carruthers more closely will highlight that his conceptualization and work within Africana or Black Studies is intent to push the boundaries of the forms of knowledge and the ways of being to see it as an intellectual project driven by a liberationist ethic. For Carruthers, Africana Studies is not simply an area of theoretical inquiry, but a critical ground upon which intellectual warfare was and is waged. Kamal Rashid expands this notion to suggest that this intellectual war is not simply over the development of a body of knowledge focused upon African people, but was over the means of intellectual production, that is, the ideational matrix that interprets the world through a particular cultural lens and seeks to reorder the world's political economy along lines consistent with its interests. This is why Carruthers' focus on identifying, extracting, and mapping Africana history, often Nile Valley history, was generally subsumed by his study of historiography, and with it, the study of the craft of historical knowledge production from antiquity to the present, and its inextricable links to the political economy of nations. For Carruthers, a truly revolutionary theory of liberation for African people must be based on an African worldview. He maintained that such a framework not only went beyond the critique of the political and economic arrangements of European domination, but also interrogated the cultural foundations of a fundamental alienation which makes misery and strife the inescapable derivatives of European systems of domination. It is then necessary to engage in a deep study of the fundamental structure of culture, its material and non-materiality, as an essential frame for reconstruction and a realignment of the cultural orienting principles that seek to balance a society. Al-Mikal Cabral, the revolutionary intellectual who fought to secure freedom from Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, once suggested, not directly in these words per se, but as a summation of his actually written and verbal thought, and certainly in his practice, that you measure a people's potential for liberation based on how different their culture is from their oppressors. It is from here we can see another concern in the work of Carruthers, as highlighted by Kamal Rashid, which is concerned with the promise and tragedy of the Black intellectual. According to Rashid, Carruthers in Black Intellectuals and the Crisis in Black Education points to the root of the crisis with Black intellectuals as being in the processes of overt and covert socialization that trains Africans to maintain a social order that is generally antithetical to their interests. It is also here that Carruthers expressed the need for African thinkers who are wedded to the well-being of their people and the actualization of an order predicated on African freedom to call upon the Africana deep well of intellectual production by engaging in an intentional study, extraction, and application of practices from this deep well to construct sustainable paths to maintain corrective and generative practices of resistance, internal and external. It is here a foregrounding of a liberationist ethic or ethic of liberation is evident. More specifically, Carruthers note the limitations of attempting to reform European social systems or paradigms, calling instead for a process of merging a re-Africanization with social transformation, paying attention to the particular needs of a peoples who have been forced to develop in a world order as colonial beings. Today, we are in conversation with Kamal Rashid on his recently published Jacob H. Carruthers and the Restoration of an African Worldview, Finding Our Way Through the Desert. Dr. Kamal Rashid is currently professor and founding director of the Urban Education Doctoral Program at Northeastern Illinois University. Dr. Rashid earned his PhD and BA from University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and a Master of Arts degree from Northeastern Illinois University. Dr. Rashid's work focuses on African American history and culture, particularly on the intergenerational dynamics of Africana social critique, which includes an exploration and theorizing of W.E.B. Du Bois, as well as contemporary African-centered scholars and critical race theorists, and is a practitioner of African fighting arts as an intellectual and philosophical cultural tradition and practice. He is currently working on a book that explores the critical theory of W.E.B. Du Bois and has published a number of peer-reviewed articles, book chapters, as well as received various grants to support his work. Lastly, and likely most importantly, Dr. Rashid is active in a number of community organizations in the Chicago area, including the Comedic Institute of Chicago, a research and educational organization focused on mapping, exploring, and applying contributions of ancient Nile Valley civilizations. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Listen intently, think critically, act accordingly.
Thank you, Brother Kamal Rashid, for taking the time to come back again, yet again, to have a robust discussion and conversation this time on one of your recent publications, your book on Jacob H. Carruthers and the Restoration of an African Worldview, Finding Our Way Through the Desert. Thank you for taking the time to join us again.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. Very good to be here.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's a very important time to be having a discussion, particularly around the structures of thought, particularly in the context of an African worldview at this particular juncture, as there is seemingly ripples and also fractures in the current system of modernity that, of course, capitalism and imperialism and colonialism all keeps up structured. You provided a very rich text, brother. I mean, as I was kind of joking with you just a few seconds ago, you know, I was just saying I had to stop in order to actually have this conversation with you, because, you know, you didn't have two days, but again, as we, you know, there's also more conversation that we can have. But as a way of diving into our conversation, I wanted to pull out a few things that jumped out to me as I was engaging the work. A lot of this is particularly in the book, but you kind of give this in the throughout the book, but also in the table of contents and things like that. So we're also not going to talk about everything, because we want people to get enough from this conversation to go get the book, but also engage in their own study groups, engage in their own study, you know, conversations, because there is a collectivism that also produced this work, produced Jacob Carruthers. Yep. So I'm interested in centering our conversation around these particular themes, the disciplinarity and limitations of disciplinarity, intellectual maroonage, and also this fundamental alienation concept. And as we kind of get into that conversation, of course, I'm definitely interested in, you know, engaging a little bit more in intellectual warfare, science and oppression, the conceptualization of looking at Haiti, very important, but all again, back to intellectual warfare. But before we get into that, let's set the context. That's at the context of what produced, you know, Jacob Carruthers, the intellectual formation that he was engaged in and produced him, because I think that is very important as we kind of map through these particular categories of thought.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. Dr. Carruthers, you know, he came, you know, grew up in Texas, went to university in Colorado. But I think in terms of his development as someone who would ultimately become an African Senate thinker, I think the context of Chicago, particularly Chicago in the late 1960s, early 1970s, was fundamental to that. You know, when he arrives in Chicago, he arrives within the milieu of the Black Power movement, right? And so within that domain, you had very, very, very significant ideological discourses pertaining to Black liberation and different schools of thought pertaining to Black liberation. And one of the things he would say often is that it was his colleague, Dr. Anderson Thompson, who converted him to Black nationalism. This was always very interesting to me. He said that Dr. Thompson single-handedly, I think he would add, converted him to Black nationalism. And this is very interesting. This is very interesting because Dr. Carruthers, as he begins to take part in the movement, you know, is attempting to deal with, attempting to explore the conceptual foundations of liberatory struggle, right? Not just the methods and tactics which are employed in struggle, but the conceptual foundations on which those tactics are sustained. And so he would be surrounded by thinkers like Anderson Thompson, like Bobby E. Wright, like Harold Pates and others who would contribute significantly to his thinking about, again, one, the role of conceptual knowledge and the capacity of a people to free themselves, the importance of history, or more specifically, relative to his writing, historiography, or the conceptualization, the methodological and conceptual frameworks from which historical knowledge is produced, and also the role of institutions as vehicles of a liberatory struggle. So this context, particularly in the 1960s and 70s, is fundamentally important in terms of shaping him. As later in the decade, later in the 70s, right about this in the introduction to the book, takes a sabbatical from Northeastern Illinois University, goes to Africa, really looking for a model of African-centered education that can inform, at that time, the inner city studies. There was a degree program, eventually both a master's as well as an undergraduate degree program, but looking for an African-centered model around which the curriculum could be oriented. And of course, Dr. John Henry Clark wrote a letter of introduction for him to meet with Dr. Sheikh Hunter Job, and it would be that encounter with Dr. Sheikh Hunter Job, which would also have a fundamental impact on his thinking. And so on one hand, Dr. Carruthers is shaped by the milieu of Chicago during this period and the thinkers in that milieu, most notably people, again, like Dr. Anderson Thompson, Dr. Bobby E. Wright, and others. In addition to that, of course, he's dealing with thinkers who in other parts of the United States, like Dr. John Henry Clark and John G. Jackson and Dr. Yosef Ben Yochanan and others, particularly these thinkers coming out of New York who have been fundamental in terms of developing what Dr. Greg Kamathi Carr calls his African-centered philosophy of history. And then, of course, you have Sheikh Hunter Job, who was just a profoundly significant and profoundly dynamic thinker as it relates to African history. And I would say the third context, which also shaped and framed his thinking, which also grew inexorably out of the Chicago group or the Chicago school, was his the context of the 19th century Black thinkers. You know, the thinkers, people like Martin Delaney and others. It would also be the context and them attempting to continue some of the work and really to reclaim some of the intellectual legacy of those 19th century Black thinkers that would also have a profound impact on his work and his thinking.
And these conversations, particularly that are going on in Chicago and also in other places, these contestations between the ideas of strategy and practices towards liberation becomes very important. And when we're thinking about theory and practice, right? So, Jacob Carruthers is really thinking or pushing us or those who are engaged in liberatory practices to really think about how are you conceptualizing the world and building a particular strategy, a tactic towards liberation. Mm-hmm. And this obviously brings us to, you mentioned, when we talk about disciplinarity and we talk mm-hmm. about alienation, talk about the relationship, and then we'll go back because he writes about Sheikh Abdou Diop, and you write about this in the book of being very important in informing the way that he's thinking about African knowledge systems and how it can, in a pan-African context, talk about this conceptualization of the fundamental alienation and how, mm-hmm. in chapter 4, you talk about disciplinarity and the limitations of European mm-hmm. knowledge, which brings him to Africa, of course.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So,
please dive in.
Yeah. So, it's interesting because one of the things I should say that my initial encounter with Dr. Carruthers' ideas was via his book, Essays in Ancient Egyptian Studies, which I purchased when I was an undergrad. But my second encounter with him would be when I was a graduate student at Northeastern Illinois University. And that was purely by happenstance that I ended up being a grad student, purely by happenstance. I did not have some grand plan, grand strategy. I just really stumbled into the place quite literally in a number of ways. Well, one of the things that was a part of the discourse while I was there, and I was a graduate student at Northeastern Illinois University in the Inner City Studies program from 2000 to 2002. And one of the things that was a part of the discourse, again, both with him and Dr. Anderson Thompson, as well as Professor Leon Harris, was the idea of studying the oppressor. One of the things that they emphasize is that we have to understand the worldview of the people who oppress us, that we have to understand their worldview in order to understand not only the system of oppression in which we are situated, but also the fundamental limitations of us attempting to use that conceptual frameworks as a way to free ourselves. And this is, you know, a key part of his thinking. He argued that the Western worldview was predicated upon certain fundamental assumptions about the nature of reality, the nature of reality itself. And he also argued that those fundamental assumptions were in fact ancient in origin. One of the things that he concluded that within the context of the Western ethos is this idea of conflict as the quintessential expression of reality. That is, conflict as the basic form of relationality in human social relations. You see this, and he would talk about, I took a class with him when I was there, Literature of Tricontinental Antiquity. And so it was a class we read the literature of Mesopotamia, Greece, and so forth. I think we even may have read parts of the Bible while we were there in that course. And one of the things, of course, that was a recurring theme in these literatures was conflict on both the mundane, but also the cosmic scale. So he would describe, you know, so one of the things that you glean from his writings is that fundamental alienation in the ancient context occurred as a conceptualization of conflict between humanity, that is man versus man versus woman, man versus gods, God versus gods, and so on. And so conflict is, again, this thing which is the fundamental expression of reality. That conflict is both inescapable as well as inevitable. And that conflict is also necessarily a means whereby linear progression, linear transformation in society is achieved. This is also a part of that discourse as well. So if we jump forward a bit to thinkers like Francis Bacon and others, what we find is this idea around this alienation or this separation between humanity and nature. Because again, what's at the heart of fundamental alienation is this idea of inherent separation, right? Because we're separated from people with whom we're in conflict. And so part of what it emerges as a consequence of this is this estrangement of humanity from nature, right? Then not only is humanity separated from nature, I guess the question becomes, why is humanity fundamentally separate from nature? Because nature is something which is a scourge to the existence of humanity, right? That nature is something which plagues humanity, whether we're talking about animals or whether we're talking about weather events, the elements and so forth. And so since nature is something which essentially wars upon humanity, then nature itself must also be controlled. And so again, this idea of fundamental alienation also extends to our relationship with the earth itself. And so he would write about how thinkers like Francis Bacon argued that nature itself had to be controlled. Nature itself had to be subject to exploitation as a means of optimizing the living conditions or optimizing human life. And he would argue that when you looked at the major Western thinkers, these ideas of fundamental alienation were ever present. And the consequences of this, the consequences of fundamental alienation, because again, I talked about this in the cosmic sense, I talked about it in the social sense, but what this meant in practice is the creation of societies where institutional frameworks, social norms, values, and so forth function in such a way so as to create inescapable and unending conflict. Whether we're talking about the nature of what is called democracy within the context of ancient Greece, specifically ancient Athens, where, you know, really the majority of the population were excluded from the democratic process, that only free men were allowed to vote, enslaved people and women couldn't vote. This is, again, you know, but this is the standard of democracy. For Dr. Carruthers, he would argue that this is actually a perfect example of fundamental alienation, where you have a society where the stratification of privilege necessarily, you know, inevitably creates discord, social discord. You know, and he would write about this, and he talks about this in his essay on political science and intellectual warfare, how in the Greek worldview, the very idea of politics was one that necessitated a conflict between parties who have differing interests in terms of who are both vying for power. Again, politics being a process whereby different parties who are vying for power are engaged in incessant conflict with each other. And so for him, fundamental alienation was something which existed in the context, in the conceptual repertoire of the West, which is evident in philosophical discourses, theological discourses, and the like. But it also had implications in terms of the types of social systems that people created, that is, systems of governance, but also in terms of how people related to the environment. And so an essay, of course, that he writes in 1972, Science and Oppression, is one where he bears this out. And he talks about how within the European enterprise of science, again, building on this foundation of Francis Bacon, science in the Western paradigm, predicated upon the assumptions of fundamental alienation, was less concerned about finding ways in which humans can coexist, or rather humans can exist harmoniously within the context of their natural environment. Rather, it was about a process of devising means whereby humans could dominate their environment and bend nature to their will via, and facilitate the maximum exploitation of resources. And one of the things that he argues very effectively in this essay is that this idea of bending nature to the will of humanity also extended to humanity, more specifically, the majority of humanity that was non-European, right? So Africans, and other Asians and other people, indigenous people in the Americas and so on. And so for him, fundamental alienation was characterized the essence of the European worldview. And the reason why this has to be understood is because even in the context of the West, where discourses are created, where discourses are advanced, which purport to alleviate or to ameliorate the situation, even in the context of the West, where social theories are proposed or theories are advanced in response to the conditions of humanity born of oppression, born of the various systems of oppression, whether we're talking about capitalism or systems of gender inequality, imperialism, and the like, in many respects, he would argue, those conceptual frameworks themselves are also embedded within the context of fundamental alienation based on their fundamental assumptions about the very nature of reality itself. And so if fundamental alienation is then the starting point in terms of the European worldview, and that knowledge systems which emerge from that milieu necessarily both reflect as well as reinforce fundamental alienation, then this also has implications for knowledge production. And again, one of the things that he argues in that essay, both his essay Science and Oppression, but also an essay that he would write about 6 years later on the idea of this inner city studies as a type of discipline, he begins to interrogate this idea of what implications does disciplinary knowledge itself have to certainly the project of African liberation, but also more broadly, our conceptions of knowledge itself, And one of the things that he's constantly addressing the degree to which many of us accept Western premises as universal. Because again, the West has been very intentional about advancing the idea of the universality of Western knowledges, Western paradigms, Western models, Western institutional frameworks, and the like. These are often presented to us as things which are not Western in essence, but are in fact universal, right? That is suitable and applicable to all of humanity. And even beyond that, of course, the idea is also impressed upon us that for all of its inherent problems, that the system which the West has created also represents the apex of human achievement, not simply the apex of Western hegemony in the world, but rather the apex of the totality of human possibility, which are very bold and dubious claims, to be sure. But he argued that the construction of disciplinary knowledge had significant implications in terms of how we as African intellectuals conceived of knowledge and how we operationalize that knowledge in service of to our efforts to liberate ourselves. In that essay, Science and Oppression, I'm trying to think if he does this in this essay. I mean, he certainly does it in that essay, the essay on the inner city studies, inner city studies is a type of discipline, as well as his book, Metu Netra, and of course, in Intellectual Warfare. He deals with the ways in which knowledge are constructed and suggests that if we are concerned about formulating a conceptual basis from which to wage liberatory struggle, and also beyond that, forging a paradigm around which the world itself can and should be reconceptualized, then it necessarily required a break, right? A departure from the dominance of Western knowledge systems. And so this begs the question then, How did our ancestors think about, let's say, the past or what we call history? How did our ancestors think about what the West calls politics or what Dr. Carruthers has simply referred to as governance? How did our ancestors think about the mind or human consciousness or what the West calls psychology? And one of the things that is critical in terms of his analysis is that he argued that these disciplinary frameworks that the West has created, and although there have been many laborious efforts by African intellectuals, especially since the 1970s and perhaps further back if we talk about history, but the 1970s on, if in the context of psychology and so forth, to Africanize, right, those frameworks, to interject within those frameworks African-centered modalities. You especially see this in the context of psychology. He argued that in many respects, those systems in themselves, psychology, philosophy, history, were conceived upon the basis of paradigms which are in many ways fundamentally distinct. In fact, fundamentally dissimilar, perhaps would be the better way to think about this, to how knowledge was constructed within the context of African, both classical as well as traditional societies. And so one of the things that I attempt to do in the book is not only to explore his thinking about disciplinarity, that is, the way in which he saw disciplinarity as, that is, the construction of knowledge or the organization of knowledge into particular academic disciplines, with the refinement of that, the creation of subdisciplines. But he also attempted to operationalize a way of conceptualizing knowledge construction, that is, ideation apart from those frameworks, but predicated upon the structural dynamics, again, of classical and traditional African societies. And so perhaps the best two examples of this, which are evident in his work, are his work around thinking about governance. And he writes about this to a certain extent in his book, Metal Nature, Intellectual Warfare. But my favorite treatment of this is in his book, Metal Nature, Divine Speech. And of course, he also deals with this idea of philosophy. And he takes it up, particularly, I think, in the first part of his book, Metal Nature as well, that again, when people say philosophy, we're talking about a disciplinary framework, a system of knowledges which tend to be oriented around Western modes of knowledge production. It's not that Africans didn't engage in deep thought, but he would argue that the conception as well as the operationalization of that knowledge within traditional societies was dissimilar from what came to be known in the West as philosophy. And I think the implications of this is that it positions us to think dynamically about the way in which our ancestors conceived of knowledge and the way in which they engage in processes of knowledge construction, which in fact, by their very nature, would reflect interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary, or to use Shekhar Job's term, pluridisciplinary ways of understanding, right? If you read Nana Fukuyama's work and he talks about healing, it is without coincidence that he talks about healing in the context of land, that he talks about in the context of agriculture, that he talks about in the context of relationality, in the context of dance and music and so on, because within the context of traditionally classical African societies, the approach to knowledge construction was not as segregative as it became in the West. Knowledges were in many respects entangled, or it's not even the best word, knowledge systems were in many respects interwoven, would be a better way of thinking about this. You had an interwoven knowledges pertaining to healing, pertaining to music, pertaining to agriculture, pertaining to socialization, pertaining to governance and the like. These systems were interwoven. And so this necessarily, our awareness of this then behooves us to think about not only the way in which those knowledge systems operated, but also to think about the implications of this in terms of, again, how we wage a liberatory struggle, how we build institutions that are focused on both facilitating our own transformation of consciousness, but beyond this, the transformation of the world, and also how these knowledge systems themselves seek to nullify the type of fundamental assumptions within the Western paradigm, which in many ways are inimical, not only to human well-being, but also to the earth itself.
You're listening to a portion of a recent conversation with Dr. Kamal Rashid, who is professor and founding director of the Urban Education Program at Northeastern Illinois University. In the conversation with African Isles executive producer and co-host James Pope, Dr. Kamal Rashid explores Jacob H. Carruthers and the restoration of an African worldview. The music in the background is Africano by Earth, Wind & Fire. And we play that remembering Earth, Wind & Fire's founder and leader, Maurice White's birthday, which is December 19. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. During this holiday season, you can give the gift of your jazz and justice station, WPFW, to a friend, family member, or yourself. Today through Tuesday, December 31st, is your last opportunity to make a tax-deductible donation to WPFW for 2024. WPFW 89.3 FM is the gift that keeps on giving because of you since 1977. Your financial contributions allow WPFW to be heard by those who need the vital news, music, and perspective the station provides at 89.3 FM or online at wpfwfm.org and other streaming platforms. Donate at wpfwfm.org. You can also text to donate by simply texting WPFW-FM, not case sensitive, to 801801. That's 801801. And then follow the instructions. Because of you, WPFW, since 1977, has been making strives to build a better world, one broadcast at a time. And now we're going to go back to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope in conversation with Dr. Kamal Rashid, who is exploring Jacob H. Carruthers and the restoration of an African worldview.
And thank you for that. One of the things that I was thinking about, you know, is there's clearly a differentiation in the purpose of knowledge production from an African worldview and a European world, which also maps the way that this idea of reality is conceptualized from a European epistemic understanding of the world, which is very limited. Because if we think about, just take history in the context and its relationship to humanity from an African worldview, there is this synergy, there is this relational, as you talk about, and this flow in and out, because knowledge that's being produced by understanding and interacting with each other, nature, and the universe is producing ways of understanding the world that is dissimilar to a Eurocentric, which is also very isolated in the context. So there's a time construct here, how time is conceptualized, how much time one has, one's relationship with ancestors. So again, so these structures that are coming out are very, very clear in the work of Carruthers and I will say Edit All, because he's part of a collective as well.
Exactly.
And I think that, you know, so to think about history is innately to think about the future in the context of an African worldview.
How would
Carruthers, and you write about this in there, but I want to tease this out a little bit more, you know, these disciplinarities. Disciplinarity is very, very important to understand in the context of separating or alienation of knowledge, knowledge production, the purpose of knowledge, and those type of things. So there's a time construct. History's not looked at in a linear fashion. I mean, there's many ways that we can go with that, but, you know, this purpose of knowledge is what you're getting at, right? In an African worldview, it's towards liberatory practices in relation to attempts to arrest the African humanity. But how do we think about that in a future context? How do we think about this beyond struggle?
And that's the thing that I think is so critically important. You know, in a number of places in his writing, you know, he talks about the need to reorder the world, right? And I love the way he renders this, because we'll talk about the importance of nullifying the capacity of the oppressors to oppress us and to organize the world itself, to reorganize the world itself on the basis of an African worldview. Well, what are the implications of this? One of the things that's interesting about Dr. Carruthers' thinking, and you see this especially with regards to his thinking about education, which I'll write about, I think, in chapter two and three, but chapter two is the one that I'm thinking about. I'll use his writings in education as an example, because I think it captures the way he's thinking about time. He argues in that essay, first, of course, in that chapter, rather, I talk about his conception of education in ancient Kemet, right? And he talked about one of the things that, of course, education was focused on achieving was the transmission of vital knowledge necessary to sustain the society. That is, educational processes of socialization were focused on the development of intergenerational, or the perpetuation, I should say, of intergenerational continuity. That is, to ensure that the knowledge of the ancestors and the elders were passed on to the youth. Of course, also the cultivation of good character was an element of this. So there was an ethical dimension to this also. And to be sure, education was also focused on the transmission of technical knowledge as necessary in order to sustain the operations of, right, of society. You know, he talks about how within the context of the Ma'afa, Europeans attempt to disrupt this process of socialization and to make the process of socialization that African people are recipients of one that would serve their interest. And so rather than us being socialized in such a manner so as to perpetuate our own future, so as to build and sustain and to carry ourselves into the future, socialization or education processes were instead appropriated and utilized to facilitate European domination. So this is the second stage that he talks about in terms of, you know, this process. And the third, of course, being African-centered education, the emergence of African-centered education as a means of essentially us reclaiming our minds, you know, reclaiming our consciousness, developing a capacity to, again, not only engage in struggle, but also organize the world. And so in his discussion of education, what you see is this idea that African people had a particular approach to education, one which was predicated upon, he would argue in the context of the Nile Valley, predicated upon ma'at, right? That is, you know, truth, order, and so forth, justice, righteousness, that Europeans would attempt to disrupt that process for the sake of creating a system whereby you produce the individuals within it. Europeans would attempt to create a system of education and socialization, which would attempt to render those who are recipients of that process into being not only the subjects, but the instruments whereby that system would be perpetuated. That is, for African people to, you know, sustain the very system of oppression, of European oppression, on behalf of Europeans. And of course, the third stage being us developing a system to liberate ourselves, a system that would seek to transform our consciousness, to throw off the yoke of European consciousness and the like. Well, within each of those, within each, which in the first and third temporal domains is an attempt, well, I'm sorry, within the third temporal domain is an attempt to reclaim or to restore a particular order, right, that's operative in the first. In his view, and this is, I think, the problem with a lot of the ways in which many Black thinkers and many advocates of social change among our people, we have positioned ourselves in a hopelessly reactive posture in relation to the West. That is, that our project is limited. Unfortunately, for some of us, our project is limited only to the objectives of reform. For some of us, there's a broader political projects related to transformation, but in some respects, it may not be comprehensive. Dr. Carruthers, the idea was to attempt to use the conceptual and social template of our ancestors is a means by we both conceive of and enact transformative change. That is, what should the world look like? That is, what would be the optimal conditions under which we are able to live as a people? And so for him, the ends of inquiry, that is, the ends of knowledge production, are the facilitation or the emergence, the concretization of that type of reality. Why do we study the past? We study the past so that we can develop, we study our past so that we can use our past as a means whereby we both understand the present and shape the future. Why do we study African spiritual practices in order to understand the ways in which those spiritual practices facilitated a certain type of interrelation between humanity as well as nature, so that we can understand the necessity of restoring those types of, those models of interrelation in the present. And so for him, the production of knowledge itself wasn't simply about how we understand or articulate our understanding of a particular thing. You know, his conception of disciplinary knowledge, I would argue in many respects, is something which exists or which must necessarily exist outside of also the institutional frameworks of the academy itself. And this is, I think, if you think about the organization of, you know, at least two of the organizations that he founded, the Kemetic Institute of Chicago and the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations, within each of those is an orientation towards the development of folks of grassroots communal, you know, intellectuals, folks, you know, intellectuals who are engaged, who are from the community, who are of the community, who are engaged in this process of knowledge production relative to the fact that the goal of this process is nothing less than the transformation of reality. So the study of the past is fundamentally important. And he writes about this, you know, particularly in terms of his discourse on historiography. And he argued that, and again, because I really appreciate what you said, that, you know, Carruthers et al., because indeed, right, you know, he would, in fact, you know, when he would lecture, he would always bring greetings, you know, from the Kemetic Institute, from the Temple of the African Community of Chicago. He always knew that he was an emissary of a particular community, that these ideas that he himself was engaged in sharing, that these were ideas which emanated from a community, that they were ideas that were nurtured within the context of community. And of course, you also see this in his writings, right? You know, for instance, The Irritated Genie, the whole discussion of Bobby E. Wright and the significance of the ideation of Bobby E. Wright to that project. And I take some of that up in this book. Well, at any rate, when he talks about historical knowledge, historical knowledge was always about this idea of futurity. And he argued that when you study the emergence of a type of Pan-African historiography, really within the context of the 19th century, right, especially with among thinkers like Martin Delaney would play a very, very significant part of this, as well as others. But when you look at the formation of Pan-African historiography among 19th century Black thinkers, particularly in the United States, what you have in that discourse is an orientation towards understanding African history, which has, in many respects, two distinct polarities. One that is two conceptual continuums. One end of that deals with the Nile Valley as a model or as an archetype of African historical achievement. The other polarity deals with the Haitian Revolution, you know, and the Haitian Revolution in this case signifies the capacity of Africans to reshape the world in their image and interest. And so for these 19th century thinkers, you know, who again contribute to the formation of Pan-African historiography, the development of historical knowledge was predicated upon the reclamation of the African past, of which the Nile Valley and the focus on the Nile Valley was a signifier, but also B, the understanding and operationalization of Africans' capacity to engage in revolutionary struggle for the sake of not only nullifying systems of oppression, but also achieving self-determination. So Carruthers really inherits this idea, which is why I made the point earlier that part of, you know, the milieu that is nurturing him or that's shaping his thinking is, you know, are people who are contemporaries of his, relatively speaking, right, Dr. Thompson, Dr. Wright, and so on, as well as his elders like Dr. Clark and also Sheikh Hunter Jope, but also his predecessors, especially these 19th century African thinkers, which become a key focus for these thinkers within the context of the Chicago School. And so for them, the future and their notions of futurity were necessarily oriented around this idea of really perhaps we can situate this in the context in the simple question, what should the world be for African people? What is the type of world that African people should exist in, and how does our understanding of the past inform that world? He argued that if we were to endeavor to transform the reality on the basis of the European worldview, that is, on the basis of fundamental alienation, all that would result is the reproduction of the European ethos. That is, the reproduction of the European ethos with simply African people as the stewards, the managers, or the overseers of such a system. And I would argue that perhaps the evidence of that was what happened in Haiti under Toussaint, where you had the perpetuation of the plantation system and the people continued to engage in unrest because the goals of the revolution articulated by Bukman had not been realized. And so for him, the only solution out of this malaise, that is the only solution out of the malaise of not only the current domination of Europeans, but also an attempt to simply preserve that system, but under the aegis of people in blackface, was the need for us to create something that was fundamentally different, that was based on different paradigmatic notions of reality. And so, and I should say as an aside, right, the implications of this are multiple because we are inundated, and this is election season, and so even now we're inundated with this, whereby we are constantly told that the path to progress is the structural assimilation of African people within the context of Western hegemony. And so we engage in celebratory glee when the face of Western empire is a black face. is if this in some way signifies a transformation of our condition or a transformation of the world itself in a manner which is optimal for humanity as a whole. And again, he argued that it was necessary for us to see beyond those types of conceptual blinders, to see beyond those limitations, and to, again, strive for a much broader reconceptualization of reality, that is the restoration of order, that is the restoration of Ma'at in the world as being an end goal, as it were.
You've just been listening to a portion of a conversation with Dr. Kamal Rashid exploring Jacob H. Carruthers and the restoration of an African worldview. Dr. Kamal Rashid is currently professor and founding director of the Urban Education Doctor Program at the Northeastern Illinois University. Dr. Rashid's work focuses on African-American history, culture, and particularly on the intergenerational dynamics of Africana social critique, which includes an exploration and theorizing of W.E.B. Du Bois, as well as contemporary African-centered scholars and critical race theorists. The full conversation with Dr. Kamal Rashid and African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope will be on African Now's SoundCloud page. That's African Now Online on SoundCloud. African Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Yarabi by Sona Jobate. An upcoming program note, join WPFW on December 15 during our holiday party, which will feature light refreshments and also music with DJs Abby, Lance Reynolds, and Funk. And that's on Sunday, December 15, 4:30 to 9 p.m. And that'll be at WPFW 1990 K Street Northwest, Suite 14R. That's 1990 K Street Northwest, Suite 14R in Washington, D.C. Space is limited. You must RSVP before December 13 at WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. That's it for African Hour for today. I'm your host, Muizu Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shanana with Zain Al-Amin, looking at issues in the Northern African region and also the Middle East, particularly spotlighting the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by Sophie's Parlor, the Women's Collective, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Combit Lakai with Eugenia Charles. And that looks at issues in Haiti. Check out African Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at African Now Online. Also, African Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under African Now Online on SoundCloud. That's African Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to African Now's executive producer and co-host, James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nasella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Funa Ngonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. Remember, from now until December 31st, we ask you to embrace radical generosity and donate to WPFW, a medium that has contributed so much to improve the lives of so many through our music and message programming. Visit WPFWFM.org to make a tax-deductible donation to WPFW for 2024. Your year-end gift is essential to WPFW's ability to continue to build a better world one broadcast at a time. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Mama Africa by Columbia Africa, the Mystic Orchestra, and Luis Towers, featuring Dali Kimoko and Nyiboma. The team of Africa Now wishes you a happy holiday season and a happy new year. And stay safe.
WPFW in Washington, and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Israeli airstrikes in Gaza overnight hit a refugee camp and a home housing displaced people, killing at least 29 people. A family of eight was among the people killed, according to hospital records, including four children. Militants in central Gaza fired four rockets into Israel today, two of which were intercepted, according to the IDF. The other two projectiles fell in open areas, and no casualties were reported. Israel then issued evacuation orders for a five-block area in a central Gaza refugee camp, claiming the rockets were fired from there. Israel has killed over 44,000 Palestinians since the war began last October, and thousands more Palestinians have gone missing. United Nations officials warned that the roughly 70,000 people believed to remain in northern Gaza could be experiencing famine amid an Israeli blockade on humanitarian aid. In domestic news, Luigi Mangione, the man accused of killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in Manhattan last week, is contesting his extradition to New York State after his arrest in Pennsylvania on Monday. Mangione's lawyer told reporters yesterday that he is pleading not guilty to the charges he was arrested on in Pennsylvania, including forgery and possession of a firearm without a license. He also faces charges in New York of second-degree murder, forgery, and three gun violations. Mangione struggled with police as he entered a Pennsylvania courtroom yesterday, yelling to reporters about, quote, an insult to the intelligence of the American people. Judge David Consiglio denied bail to Mangione. A Pennsylvania DA said Mangione's decision to fight extradition to New York would not significantly delay his transfer. Multiple media outlets are reporting that a fingerprint found on a cell phone discarded near the site of the murder matches Mangione's. Firefighters in Southern California are battling a wildfire near Malibu as evacuation orders and warnings have been issued to at least 20,000 people in the region. The Franklin Fire has burned nearly 4,000 acres and is only 7% contained as of this morning, according to the state fire agency. Los Angeles County's fire chief told reporters last night that about 1,500 firefighters have been deployed. At nearby Pepperdine University, some 3,000 students were sheltering in place. A university official said parts of the campus had been singed, but reported no serious damage. Strong Santa Ana wind gusts reaching 40 miles per hour have fanned the flames and are expected to last through today. The cause of the Franklin fire is still under investigation. The New York Attorney General's office is saying it will not drop its civil fraud case against Donald Trump, despite a demand from the president-elect to do just that. A judge ruled last year that Trump's business repeatedly inflated his net worth to secure better loan terms over a decade of business dealings, and Trump was ordered to pay $454 million plus interest. Trump appealed the judgment, and a ruling is still pending. In a statement yesterday, New York AG Letitia James made it clear that her office would continue to pursue the case, arguing that presidents do not have immunity from civil litigation arising from unofficial conduct, and lawsuits may proceed while the president is in office. And Senate Republicans yesterday blocked a bipartisan bill designed to provide journalists with greater protections against government intrusion. the Protect Reporters from Exploitative State Spying Act, also called the Press Act, failed to advance following an objection from Senator Tom Cotton, who argued it posed a risk to national security. The Press Act, which passed the GOP-led House earlier this year, sought to prevent the government from compelling journalists to disclose their sources and limit the seizure of their data without their knowledge. President-elect Trump urged Republicans to, quote, kill this bill in a Truth Social post last month. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 63 degrees and rainy. In New York City, 59 degrees and overcast. For WPFW in Washington,